So turn with me this morning to Exodus chapter 1. Exodus chapter 1. In just a minute, we're going to resume our studies of Old Testament history. Beginning, of course, at verse 1. If you're keeping count, this is part 55 of our series in Old Testament history, or if you prefer, the history of the unfolding of God's plan of redemption. After all, that's what history is all about. Before we begin, though, to look at chapter 1, let me first give you a little background on this second book of the Pentateuch. First things first, where did the name of the book originate? It's not as though Moses sat down and said, "Oh, I know, I'm writing about this mass exodus of the Israelites from captivity in Egypt. I'll call it the Exodus." That's not quite how things worked back then. Back then, a book was generally entitled according to the opening words of the book. And so in this case, this book's original title was, "These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob." And of course, again, people knew immediately what the book was going to be about just based on that simple title. The title of Exodus was actually given to the book by the translators of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek, the Septuagint. They decided to title the book Exodus as a way of indicating that this is the story of that release from captivity and the wandering of the people of Israel, the giving of God's law, and so on and so forth. How do we know that this should be the second book in the Pentateuch? Well, again, we need to understand that books weren't written necessarily in chronological order. We don't see Moses sitting down and saying, "Oh, I know, let's put these in the order of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy," and so on and so forth. We see more of a collection of scrolls that were gathered, and there are certain clues within those writings that caused modern translators and compilers of our modern translations to put them in the order that they're in today. For example, we know that the oldest book in the Old Testament is not Genesis at all. It's the book of Job. Why does it appear where it appears? Well, it appears where it appears because it makes sense to put it there. At least there was a consensus in terms of where that book should be put, and that's where they put it. In this case, we do have the hint given in that opening sentence. When is the last time Jacob and his family is spoken about? Well, it's in Genesis, and we went over that at length in our studies of that book. As for the dating of the book, most people believe that Moses wrote this particular book sometime between 1445 and 1405 BC. In fact, in Exodus 24:4, we have a reference which reads, "Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord," which most scholars believe is a reference to the Pentateuch as a whole. And similar references are made in Exodus 17:14, Exodus chapter 34, verses 4 and 27 through 29. Now, we're going to learn more about all of this as we go through the book. It's just like when we went through Genesis. I know there are a lot of unanswered questions as far as how this book was written, why it was written, when it was written, where it was written from, who was it written about, and so on and so forth. But I'd rather answer those kind of as we go through rather than just give you all of that background information this morning and have you write it down and then never discuss it again. These things are going to come up through the course of this particular study, as they did with Genesis. So, beginning at verse 1, Moses writes this: "Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each one with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Now, there's really nothing remarkable to note here. We've gone over the names of Jacob's sons. We've gone over a bit of their history. But again, that's something that we pointed out will be ongoing as we go through the book of Exodus. We're going to learn more and more, and this is going to continue throughout the Old Testament. So we need not get bogged down on certain details this morning. Let me just say this, though. If you're wondering, there's actually no rhyme or reason to how these names are presented here. Moses didn't have any sort of ulterior motives. He didn't have a real meaning, at least a discernible meaning. We can't find out what that was, in placing these names in the order that he placed them. It's very likely that he's referring to the way they had settled together, in pairs, as it were. But we can't be sure, because all of those records have been lost, if they were ever written down at all from a contemporary or secular perspective. As we progress, again, we're going to learn more about this. But I want you to understand another thing here that's often confusing. Thus far, these people are known as Israelites. And they're known as Israelites because they go all the way back to their father, Jacob, who was renamed Israel after he struggled with the Lord. They're not called Jews as of this point. As a matter of fact, they won't be called Jews till much, much, much later. I say that to prevent you from making a very common anachronistic mistake. There are a lot of people who, and I'll probably slip up and do it from time to time, referring to these people as the Jews. Well, as you know, the word Jew was a pejorative that sprang from the name Judah. And we won't see really that being used until, again, sometime later. But we need not apply that to these people. These people are Semites. These people are the descendants of Jacob, renamed Israel. They wouldn't have known anything about any name like Jew. And so, again, it's important that we get our terminology right when we're referring to this people at this particular time. Now, verse 8, let's just move on here. Now, a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Now, stop there. Who is this new king? Well, we don't have a clue, actually. We think we know, based upon certain clues that we are given throughout secular history. Again, Moses doesn't tell us who he is. There are certain hints that we can get from the text, and we'll see those in just a minute. But again, the identity of this king is not really known to us. It's not given to us. In fact, we can't even be sure of the exact time frame. And if we can't be sure of the exact time frame when all of this is happening, we certainly can't know for certain which dynasty this was. We can't know which pharaoh was in command during this particular time. I think I've shared this with you before, but let me just point it out again. Egypt's pharaoh during the time of Joseph was very likely a man named Sesostris, or he's sometimes referred to as Senusret. This pharaoh was very likely indigenous. That means he was probably born and raised in Egypt. Now, why do I mention that? Well, it's important to understand that in Egypt's history, not every ruler of Egypt was an indigenous Egyptian. Very often, Egypt found herself in a downturn period of history where things weren't going so swimmingly, and they were vulnerable to attack from foreigners. And very often, foreigners would come in and they would take over the government, and they would take over the office of the pharaoh. And, you know, everybody wanted what Egypt had. Egypt had the pyramids. Egypt had the great monuments. Egypt was seen as a prize in terms of conquest. If you could defeat the Egyptians and take over their government, then you were pretty high on the pecking order, as it were, in world affairs, at least the known world at the time. The reason I say that Sesostris was indigenous is because it's believed that this particular king that we're talking about here, that arose among the Egyptians, was not indigenous. Now, how might we know that? Well, again, we're told that this was a new king, and we're also told that he arose, and the word used or translated as arose there is a word that is almost universally used in the negative sense. In other words, he wasn't appointed, he wasn't elected, he wasn't chosen by the people, he wasn't the logical successor of the Pharaoh, office of Pharaoh. He arose among the people, which generally refers to conquest. We believe, at least most scholars, believe that this new king was from the Hyksos. Who were the Hyksos? Well, the Hyksos were a Semitic people, and as we know, the Semites come from who? Shem, right? They're Shemites, shortened to Semites. The Hyksos were a Semitic people who lived around Egypt, who are known for their campaigns of conquest. Whenever they saw a weakness, they would attack. And in this case, it's believed that this Semitic people invaded Egypt, adopted many of their customs and traditions, and eventually brought more of their own into the society as well. This can be seen most clearly in the architecture of the period. Archaeologists talk about certain changes in architecture as a way of determining whether a ruler was indigenous or a foreigner. There are just certain clues that new leaders, you know, whenever a new leader comes in, what's that new leader want to do? Well, it's out with the old and in with the new. They want to make their mark, so to speak, in terms of political agendas, aims, goals, and people as well. You know, our own political system works very much this way. I don't know if you're a big fan of the political scene. I tend to be a fairly huge political junkie, and I like to read all things political, mainly because I like to see the folly of man's delusion that he's actually in control of things. Right? And every 4 years or every 8 years, we change the man who sits in the White House, or the woman, might be a woman one time soon, but we change the figurehead in the White House. And what's one of the first things they do? Well, if it's a first lady in charge, as we know that happens a lot, then everything changes in terms of the carpet and the drapes, and they get free rein to remodel. I think there's a pretty large budget for them to remodel the White House, because they can't be in the same environment that the previous guy was in. I mean, and then the president takes the seat in the Oval Office, and what does he begin to do? He begins to write executive orders and advocate for new laws, and it's always, you know, doing this. Our government is always doing this. Everything's cyclical. It gets really bad, then it gets better, depending on your perspective. Then it gets bad and better and bad and better. And on it goes. The same thing was true in places like Egypt. Every so often, like I said, during these periods of weakness, people would come in, overthrow the ruler, bring in their own people. You know, there, you can be on the president's staff. You can be one of his closest associates today, and then the day after the election, what are you? Nothing. Probably writing your memoirs, right? You're writing a book, hoping to sell a book about all of your experiences that nobody really wants to read anyway. But there you have it. Politics is very fickle, and it was the same all the way back then. These new kings would come in and reestablish themselves as the better, more able king. Of course, as we think about all the political maneuvering that goes on throughout history, whether we see peaceful transfers of power or not, throughout it all, we would do well to remember that God is in control. God is always in control. I know a lot of people who despair over world affairs. I know people who get beside themselves with grief after every election. You know, especially if the wrong person won in their estimation. And people just get beside themselves. Even Christians can get really depressed and despondent over the political happenings in this country. And let me just say this, that should never be. Why? Because every time we're despondent, every time we complain, every time we grow discontent with who's in power, even the way things are going today, it's really kind of a slap in God's face. It's to tell God we know better than you. It's to deny that God is sovereignly in control of every aspect of human existence. And there are several places in Scripture that point to this. Let me just draw your attention to a couple of these. In Daniel chapter 2, verses 20 and 21, this, of course, is following God's revelation regarding the mystery of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Remember, nobody could interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and Nebuchadnezzar got quite upset, put several of his wise men to death, and then Daniel steps in and says, oh, I can do that. And this is following God's revelation of that, the meaning of that dream to Daniel. And Daniel says in verse 20, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. David's statement is absolutely correct. It's God who changes the times. It's God who removes kings. It's God who establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. I take great comfort in that, don't you? Knowing that God's in charge, knowing that we can look on everything that happens in the world of humanity and laugh at the folly of man who has convinced himself that he's in control. Now, not to get too political here, but this whole scam known as climate change, you know, what is climate change's first presupposition? It's that we control the weather. We don't. Now, there's nothing wrong with being good stewards, right? We should not be polluting the earth that God has given us. I mean, that should be common sense to every one of us who want to be good citizens and good stewards of what God has so graciously blessed us with. But to assume that we are able to do things which will lead to our own destruction, regardless of the fact that God and God alone determines the number of our days, that God and God alone knows when that great day is coming, when everything will be rolled up like a scroll and burned up with a fervent heat. If that ever happens, folks, you young people, hear me now. If that ever happens, it's not going to be because people didn't buy enough Teslas. It's going to be because God determined that that should happen. And if you depend on one who has the end figured out from the beginning, what great comfort is that? 1 Samuel chapter 2. 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 7. The Lord makes poor and rich. He brings low. He also exalts. So, again, there are things that you can do in the interest of good stewardship over your jobs. If you have a job, thank the Lord for that job and do that job, as Paul said to the Colossians. Do that job as unto the Lord himself. Do that job with all of your might. Do that job as a reflection of your love for God and your appreciation for his blessings. So good stewardship can be exercised over jobs as well. But if you're doing your dead level best, and if you're working as unto the Lord himself, and you're pouring yourself out in the way that many of you do on a daily basis, don't bemoan the fact that you're not being exalted, because your time of being exalted will come when God determines that that needs to happen. You can rest even in that. You know, I'm the hardest worker in the whole business, and I've not gotten a raise in 10 years. Well, it's because God has not seen fit to give you a raise. You just continue doing what you do as unto the Lord. And in the course of due time, he will exalt you if that's his plan for you. It may be that he wants you to be humble. It may be that he wants you to exist by humble means. And try as you might, you'll never be rich. But again, isn't it comforting to read here, the Lord makes poor and rich? Proverbs 8, 15 and 16. Proverbs 8 is another one of those proverbs where God is speaking as wisdom personified. And here he says, "By me kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles, all who judge rightly." Again, God's acknowledging it's only by me that those who are in positions of power enjoy those positions of power. Proverbs 21:1. We also see that God controls the hearts of those who are placed in power. "The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes." Oh, that's an evil king. You know, I've said this before, even of the devil himself. I think it was Martin Luther who said he might be the devil, but he's God's devil. He's under God's sovereign control. And there's nothing that he can do to you. There's nothing that the king can do to you. There's nothing that the president can do to you that God is not permitting him to do. The best example of this, again, we have to go to Jesus before Pilate. Remember what Pilate did? Pilate thought, well, you know, I'm pretty successful. I'm a man who's, I've been designated to be the governor of this whole land. And you stand before me, you, the son of a carpenter, who really is just little more than a rabble-rouser in the eyes of the masses. They've asked me to give them Barabbas instead of sparing your life. Now, if you're smart, you'll explain yourself, because I have the power to either put you to death or let you go free. And what did Jesus say? "Not so. You would have no power over me unless it had been granted to you from the Father." Jesus quickly sets the record straight. You know, Rush Limbaugh used to say that, you know, his talent was on loan from God. And I think Rush meant that. You know, I think he was, of course, he was not a picture of humility in all respects, but, you know, he did recognize that whatever he was by the grace of God. I don't know the level of his faith or his seriousness in that regard, but it's a true statement nonetheless. And Pilate needed to be reminded of that. Pilate, you have no power except that which is on loan from God. You who supervise people out in the business world, remember that. You are what you are by the grace of God. At the end of the day, you're just a fellow nobody. We're all just nobodies who should be talking about the only somebody that matters, which is Christ. But don't let it go to your head. You know, those of you who are overly educated, I am the quintessential example of an overeducated person. But none of my 5 degrees makes me any worthier than the person who never graduated from high school. I'm just a nobody. I'm just a nobody who had all that education paid for by the government in exchange for my military service. And I said, why not? I like to learn. Let's go. But it doesn't make anybody better. I'm the pastor of this church, along with 2 other men who serve as my co-elders, pastors. None of us has the idea that we're anything beyond your brothers in Christ. And it should stay that way, right? All of us have what we have on loan from God, even our lives. The very breath that you're breathing right now is on loan from God. The very beats of your heart are on loan from God. You do well to recognize that. Going back to our text, verses 9 and 10. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply. And in the event of war, they will also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." Again, it's even clearer now that this new Pharaoh had no idea what Joseph had done for the people of Egypt. This guy comes in. This is, again, a clearer indication that he is a foreigner. Even more significantly, he didn't know anything about Joseph's God. Why? Well, here's another important thing to understand about what we read in the Old Testament. We don't leave Genesis and go right into Exodus as if it's the next day. We're talking about a time period that by most conservative estimates is 200 to 300 years after Joseph's arrival in Egypt. It's been a long time. The people have settled the land of Goshen. The people have multiplied. The family of Jacob has expanded to the point where this new Pharaoh, whoever he is worried. It's getting out of hand. Now, did he have reason to worry? Probably not. Probably not. By all indications, and we can see this as we go into even the captivity of the Israelites, by all indications, most of them were content to mind their own business, to continue to grow. Many of them had already moved back up north to Canaan, but many of them stayed. And as they multiplied and grew, there are no records to indicate that they had any aspirations of military conquest. They weren't that kind of people. For the most part, these people are still worshiping the one true God, and they're still living in the legacy of Joseph, understanding that God is sovereignly in control, that God will determine their steps, that God has blessed them immeasurably in the land that they were in. So this new Pharaoh comes in. He's obviously not in tune with the one true God. He doesn't even understand who Joseph was, what he did. This is a man who's probably trying to turn the Egyptian society back toward the worship of idols of stone and wood. This is a man who wants to make Egypt great again. Mega. Never mind. But more importantly, this means that this new Pharaoh would have no idea the agreement that was made with the Pharaoh that Joseph served under and Jacob. Remember their agreement. As long as you agree to live peaceably here, as long as you agree that, you know, we can work together. There was a very symbiotic relationship for many, many years. Centuries, as it turns out. And had this Pharaoh understood the level of sincerity that was in Jacob and Joseph when this agreement was made, he would have seen immediately that this people is no threat militarily. This people's not out to get you. But as is common with new leaders especially, there was a lot of paranoia. You know, a new leader takes the seat in the Egyptian equivalent of the Oval Office, and he immediately begins looking around. Okay, who's out for me? And with good reason. He is a foreign conqueror. He wants to know who's gunning for me, so to speak. By all accounts, the people were peaceful, but this new Pharaoh had no way of really knowing that. Instead, he saw only one thing. They were growing in numbers sufficient to render them a threat if they ever did decide to invade, and that could not stand. So in response to this growing paranoia, Pharaoh, what's his name, decided to act preemptively. Now, what did he do? Well, he said, "Let us deal with them wisely." What does that mean? What would a wise man do? A wise man would be on his guard. A wise man would probably convene a council and bring in the leaders of this people and reason together, and then he might have learned what the agreement was, who their God was, that they had no intention of being a military power, and so on and so forth. But his brand of wisdom is much different than that. What did he do? Verse 11. So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. This is not the action of a wise man. This is the action of a despot. This is the action of a paranoid man who believes that subjugation is the order of the day instead of diplomacy. And so he decides they're going to afflict them with hard labor, and they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks and all kinds of labor in the field and all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. Now, just a couple of important observations here. First of all, many of you have probably been taught to believe that the Egyptians used Hebrew slave labor to construct the pyramids, right? Isn't that what we see in Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments? All these poor Egyptians dragging these multi-ton blocks, building the pyramids. Sorry to Cecil B. DeMille, but the pyramids had actually been around by this time for the better part of 1,500 years. Besides all that, you'd never trust slave labor, uneducated slave labor, to build something as monumental, no pun intended, as the pyramids and the other things, the obelisks, all the monuments that are known to exist throughout Egypt. You wouldn't do that. Why? Because the Egyptians were master architects. They were master mathematicians. Their understanding of things like engineering, trigonometry, physics, geometry was really unparalleled anywhere in the known world. And so building the pyramids took a great deal of skill, even among the masons, the stonemasons. I don't know if you've ever seen or studied the pyramids, but the pyramids, you see that the blocks are so level that they appear to have been cut with a stone saw. You can't even get a sheet of paper between the stones on the pyramids. They are cut that level. I mean, stonemasons today marvel at how they did that. Stonemasons today long to be able to do that even with modern machinery. And yet here are the Egyptian master craftsmen doing all these things. And so no, the pyramids and all these wonderful monuments were not built by slave labor. Instead, the slaves were building other things. The slaves were making bricks, and the slaves were also making what are referred to here as these storage cities. What was a storage city? Well, we know that Egypt was very fond of storing things. I mean, they, since the days of Joseph, when Joseph first suggested that they, in preparation for the famine, that they hoard all the grain and keep it in granaries throughout the country, that kind of stuck. And so they were masters at storing things. And so they would create these big storage locations, which would have granaries and storage tanks and storage facilities. And before long, seeing that people were coming to those storage sites to purchase their grain and their other agricultural goods, cities were built up around those, which gave even more labor to the Israelites. They would go in there and build other buildings, and businesses moved in. Some of the largest sites in Egypt now are built on the remnants of these storage cities because they became huge areas of commerce, much like some of our cities here in the United States. They grew up around whatever business was being conducted there at the time. So this is what they were busy doing. Now, we get another clue here. What's really interesting is the naming of the second of these two storage cities. Ramses. This is a clue as to who was in power or who had most recently been in power at the time these storage cities were being built, at the time of the enslavement of the Israelites. This seems to indicate that this new pharaoh might have been Ramses I. And so he named one of these storage cities after himself. Scholars believe that it was either him or his son Seti I or Ramses II. Again, we can't be sure because we don't even know when the Israelites were forced into hard labor. Some scholars have estimated that the period of enslavement proper, when they were all committed to hard labor, lasted 284 years. Others say it was only 134 years. We know that the total time that the Israelites were in Egypt was 430 years. That's revealed in Exodus chapter 12, verse 40. But we don't know at what point during that 430 years they were actually brought into slavery. Again, there's no history book that you can go to. You certainly can't go to the Egyptian history books because they've removed every reference to this people. Why? Because, again, the victor writes the history. And in this case, they weren't victorious. They ended up being victorious and able to write their own history, and they did a lot of what's going on in our country today. They revised the history to reflect best on them. Kids, again, hear me. We are not a people who tear down statues. We're not a people who erase our own history. As distasteful as some of those things are, and they are, it's much preferred to leave them where they're at and learn from them, remember the mistakes that were made by these people who were at one time thought well enough of to erect monuments to. We're not the Taliban. We're not out to erase history so that it can't be remembered. We're out to learn from history. And he who learns from history will not repeat the mistakes of history. You wonder, how have we gone so far in reverse over the last 10 years? We've gone so far in reverse because kids today in public schools are not being taught true history. They're not being taught to value their history. They're not being taught to look at the mistakes and learn from those mistakes and have constructive dialogue about what went wrong and how do we prevent that from going wrong. What's the difference between right and wrong? Is it drag queens in the library? Pornographic books in the library? No. Is it erasing our history so as to make young people believe that it never happened? No. No. The Egyptians did much the same when they wrote their own histories. And again, I'm going to make a plug for that movie, The Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus. I believe it's in the library. Is it back in the library, Robin? Yeah. It's still in the library. If you haven't seen that yet, you need to watch that. Because this particular archaeologist, historian, has gone in and shown that these things actually did happen. And there is historical record of it if you look in the right place. It's just that the Egyptians rewrote history and subsequent generations of archaeologists and anthropologists took the bait. And now that has become settled history. It's not. It's not. Anyway, with very little secular history to back any of this up, we don't know for certain when any of this actually took place. And since we don't know when it began, we really have no way of knowing how long it lasted. Anyway, in addition to building the cities, we also learned that they made these bricks. Remember one of the punishments that Pharaoh foisted on the Israelites was he made them make bricks without straw. Which is really not wise at all, is it? I mean, what are you going to do with those bricks? What do you do with bricks that are going to fall apart? Unless you want them to build things with those bricks, then those things fall apart, and then you blame them again. Right? Who knows? Verse 15. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives. You know, this is a further example of the Egyptian brand of wisdom at the time. He spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of them, who was named Shipra, and the other was named Pua. And he said, when you're helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it's a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it's a daughter, then she shall live. The word birth stool is an interesting word. It actually comes from a word that refers to two stones. So, ladies, imagine there's two boulders that are put side by side, and when it comes time for you to deliver your baby, you sit on those boulders, and a midwife sits between the two boulders and delivers your baby. Right? That was the birthing stool. Don't think in your mind that this is some wooden three-legged stool. No, it comes from the same word that describes these boulders, these rocks that were used for that purpose. Now, why would Pharaoh want to kill all the newborn males among the Israelites? Well, it's simple. Control. Huh? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, any male child born is a potential soldier. You don't let male children be born because they might grow up, especially during a time of slavery, they might grow up and become your mortal enemy. So you're going to get rid of all the male children. Now, why would they keep the female children? Well, they'd keep the female children as breeding stock. No other way to put it. You know, in a caste system such as existed in Egypt, they would farm these female children off eventually, first as slave labor, and then as wives for the Egyptians, so that they could mingle their blood with the Hebrew women. And before long, instead of raising your own enemies, you're raising your own allies, right? Because they're allowing these women to marry Egyptian men once they get of age. And that's really the reason all this was happening the way it did. No king in his right mind would be so reckless as to allow his enemy to be born right under his nose. Well, even more importantly, from the perspective of redemption, although he was not aware of it at the time, Pharaoh's killing of all the male children of Israel would accomplish the same purpose that Herod had in killing all the children 2 years old, all the male children 2 years old and younger. Remember why he did that? He did that out of paranoia. He did that because he did not want the Messiah, the prophesied Messiah, to come forth. He says, okay, I'll nip this in the bud. I'll just make it impossible. I'll cut off the line altogether. Now, Pharaoh didn't know anything about this, but the devil did. Always look behind the scenes if you're able and see God working, and also see the machinations of the devil, who no doubt was indwelling this Pharaoh and causing him to make these types of decisions, determined to wipe out any possibility that the Messiah would actually be born. The devil was infinitely aware of the promise that God had made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The devil knew that there was a seed that would spring forth from Abraham's loins, the Lord Jesus Christ, who would one day be his own conqueror. The devil knew that. And so the devil sought to thwart all of this as often as he could. Satan's always trying to thwart God's plan of redemption. So did the midwives play along? No. No. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God. Now, why did the midwives fear God? These are Egyptian midwives, by the way. Well, again, this is another testimony to the legacy of Joseph. This is an example of how Joseph's faith in the one true God permeated and trickled down even to this very day, some 200 or 300 years later. There's a whole sermon in there as well. I mean, think about the influence that you can have on subsequent generations. You know, Christians often come to me and they bemoan the fact that it just doesn't seem like their evangelism is working, as if there's a formula where you go out and say, you know, say this prayer and and be saved, and people are just flocking to you to hear what to do to be saved. That doesn't happen that way. But to the extent that you're faithful in going out into this field that's wide unto harvest and making known the name of Jesus Christ, it will have whatever effect God has designed for it to have, even if it's 200 years later. So these women feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and let the boys live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them." Well, you laugh now. Hold on. So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied, became very mighty. Because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive." In the demented mind of Pharaoh, it's likely that his intention was to have the midwives kill the boys and tell the mothers that they had been stillborn. That's why he didn't tell them, you know, it doesn't matter if the Hebrew women are quicker at delivering their babies. Kill them anyway. Well, you can't do that, because now the Hebrew women know my baby was born alive. And now you're killing my... That would have caused an uprising of biblical proportions. Right? So this Pharaoh's smarter than that in terms of street smarts. So he says, you know, I want you to, as they're being delivered, take them out. The mothers will be none the wiser. But as it was, the midwives refused. And again, because they feared God, they sought to obey God rather than men. And so they preserved these newborn baby boys. Now, let me just ask you this. Did their fear of God cause them to resort to lying? Were they lying? Scholars seem to think that there might be something to this that would absolve them from the charge of lying. It might very well be that, again, in the providence of God, this edict comes down, and unbeknownst to anyone, Hebrew women were, at least for a time, enabled to deliver their babies quickly. It could be that the Egyptian midwives dragged their feet. And intentionally, you know, they get the call, ring, ring. Well, probably not then, but I don't know how that happened. You know, the messenger comes running up to the door, you know, so-and-so's having a baby. You need to come quick. We don't know. But at that point, these God-fearing Egyptian midwives, you know, I mean, think about what you would do. A Hebrew woman's about to give birth. If it's a girl, it's going to live. If it's a boy, you're going to have to put it to death or suffer death on your own. But there is a way to kind of just let things happen. And what's that? Well, you got to put your makeup on. You got to, you know, warm up the car, warm up the chariot. You got to, you know, whatever you have to do, you're just puttering in order to delay in hopes that the baby would be born. So there's all kinds of things, you know, that could have happened in the favor of these Hebrew mothers. But at the end of the day, it all goes back to God's sovereignty, does it not? It all goes back to God's sovereign providence. I mean, how uncanny that of all the people in Egypt, this group of midwives would be God-fearing women. It's amazing, really. Unheard of, unless God himself is orchestrating things. Well, Moses writes that God was good to the midwives. People multiply. Came very mighty. He also says, because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Now, this is really fascinating. If you know anything about the culture of the day, the only women who were midwives were women who could not have children of their own. As a matter of fact, we do know historically that the office of midwife during this particular part of history, the office of midwife could not be held by any woman who was able to have kids. So it was barren women. Now, process this. Moses says that in response to their fearing God and wishing to be obedient to Him, He established households. What does that mean? It means He gave them husbands and children. Is God not good? Can you not see the goodness of God even in this? This is a dark period, folks. This is, you know, we can't even fathom being under an order. If any male child is born, he won't live to see his first sunrise. Can you imagine? And yet, as bad as it was, as dark as it was, for those who trust and obey, there's always the next morning where joy springs again. Well, Pharaoh didn't like that either. He couldn't very well put the midwives to death for something that sounded plausible enough. And face it, Pharaoh's a man. He's as gullible as they come. He's, you know, oh, Hebrew women give birth faster. Okay. Sounds good. So obviously he wasn't a doctor. So Pharaoh ramps it up. He then tells all the people, every son who is born, you're to cast into the Nile. And every daughter, you're to keep alive. And as one commentator noted, this isn't at all unlike the atrocities in Nazi Germany when Hitler commanded all of the German people to turn in their neighbors. And they did. Again, a very dark time in the history of the world. Having lived in Germany as long as we did, I had the opportunity, you know, we got there in the late 80s, and I had the opportunity to, our landlord's father was an ex-stormtrooper. And the first time I met the man, he grabbed me on both arms and tears rolling down his face. And he said in broken English, I'm sorry. If you've never been to a place like, what was it? Dachau. If you've never been to a concentration camp like Dachau, close to Munich, you really can't process all of this. But you go there and it's deathly quiet. There can be 1,000 people there. And it's deathly quiet. And many of those are the local citizens, older people, going through. The only sound you hear is the sniffling and weeping. Even today. Can you imagine living under a Pharaoh who has commanded you? If you hear a baby crying, go check. If it's a little boy, kill it. Folks, that's desperation. That's paranoia to the nth degree. If you see a little baby boy, throw it in the Nile. Well, there will be a little baby boy born. As a matter of fact, he's the author of this book. Will they throw him in the Nile? Yeah. We threw him in the Nile. Oh, not in a wicker basket. My bad, you know. But again, it's all part of God's sovereign plan. Part of his providence. And it's all leading to the birth of the seed, the promised one. The very river that was supposed to be Moses' own means of death became his means of deliverance. So stay tuned. More later, Lord willing.